want, what you want. Hi, this is Laurette Lynn, the Unplugged Mom, and I'm here as usual, getting ready to talk more out of your comfort zone. We were joined very recently by Jan Irving, and Jan Irving introduced us to the Trivium. And I say introduced, but really most of us are already quite familiar what the Trivium is. But many of us aren't exactly sure what to do with it. So Jan gave us an understanding, a basic understanding of the concept of the Trivium and why it's important to our culture and why we should all really try to pay attention to learning how to think more critically, because this is something that is I believe is a very natural and human way to process information, yet it has been schooled out of us, or as they say, we've been dumbed down as a society. And this kind of makes us more susceptible to all the artificial stimulation that's out there. And of course, I'm theorizing and drawing it back to the theory of John Taylor Gatto that we have been trained to a society of obedient citizens. So here we are. And we do see evidence of this in our culture. So how do we combat this? We combat this by learning how to think critically. And this includes an ability to look beyond the surface of a situation. Now, there are people out there that do have this ability, and maybe you're one of them and you're saying, yeah, you know, I kind of always been able to think this way, and I thought that I was just real strange. I didn't realize that we're naturally supposed to be thinking this way. And then we hear about something like Trivium, and a lot of people come to me and say, I don't know, you know, the whole concept just seems so heavy to me and complicated, and I'm going to go with more of a liberal education or a classical education. And we have a Jarrett with us today that's going to clear some of this information up for us and organize it a little bit. So Jan Irving was good enough to give us the basics and the conceptual idea of learning via the Trivium concept. And now we're going to learn how to apply it practically to our lives and with our families. Jarrett Sanchez, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm alive and kicking.
Well, that's good. That's always good to know. Ladies and gentlemen, Jarrett Sanchez is host of the Next Step podcast, which you can find more about at nextstep.podomatic.com. That's the nextstep.podomatic.com. And more interestingly, but something that I'm very excited about actually is the website that Jarrett has just started called Trivium Binder. And you can find that at triviumbinder.blogspot.com. Now, this is relatively new. And it's just starting out, but as it's unfolding, I'm watching it unfold, and it's something that I myself am getting excited about because I think this is going to be a big deal. I'm going to read this directly from the website. The idea of the Trivium Binder is that there will be a sort of standard set of materials to guide the beginning Trivium student. The materials made available can then be printed out by the student and used for study. As there is no one right way to study the Trivium, the binder is meant to be a general reference using materials that have been found to benefit the beginning studies. But the list should only be a suggested guide, a helpful resource for those who need it. And that's just a basic preliminary description of what this site is meant to be and is going to be. And I'm very excited about this because I think it will help a lot of people truly understand the Trivium. And that's why you're with us this morning, Jarrett.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm a fan of the show, and yeah, I'm sure that your audience has, you know, a lot of interest in this material, so hopefully I can give them the best stuff. That's the idea.
Well, I think you'll be able to, and can you just elaborate a little bit more on what the purpose of Trivium Binder is?
Well, yeah, you pretty much read the basics right there. It's the idea of putting together into one, like, three-ring binder. You know, just a bunch of great materials that I personally have found to be extremely useful for a beginning student. I consider myself like a first-year student of the liberal arts, which doesn't really mean much. I've known about it actually for about 2 years, but with such little free time on my hands, you know, I've really only probably progressed as much as a student would in a period of a year with a normal study schedule. So I'm a first-year Trivium student, and I'm out of the beginning stages of learning the Trivium. So I guess that somewhat qualifies me to help others get to that point as well. And that's just what the Trivium Binder is. It's going to be what I consider to be a standard set of materials that people can, you know, kind of take all of, or add to or subtract from, and just put all the materials together on their own in a three-ring binder. There it is right in front of them. They don't have to go on their computer or access any certain website or forum or anything. It'll be right there in front of them, and they can work through the material at their own speed. And then also, ideally, I would like to really start to see people forming like local study groups, you know, around the Trivium material. And so then the Trivium binder will come in real handy then when you want to say, okay, well, go ahead, print this out, or you can just print it out for the people and put it together in that nice little Trivium binder for them, and there it is.
Well, I think this is going to be a great resource, and I like the idea of it. I like the fact that you're even calling it a binder. And I remember reading something about this method of learning and actually physically using binders. Like, the suggestion was made to actually use binders because this is a way of really organizing information. And that is really the whole point of learning conceptually through the Trivium, is to organize, to be able to process and organize information in your mind and train yourself basically to organize information so that you're really benefiting from the information that's coming to you and that's being pelted at you through artificial stimulation, and you're able to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff. That's the whole point, really, is to organize the information that you're getting and be smarter about it.
Yeah, pretty much. When you have it organized, you can repeat it more easily. You know, you can present this stuff in different ways and, you know, throw in a lot of creativity.
Well, on that note, let's go ahead and in an organized way, talk about what the Trivium is, just basically in your summary. And like I said, Jan Irving was on with us, and he gave us a really well-spoken description and a deep look at the concept of learning the Trivium and why it was important for our society. So if you could just sum up now in your own words, so we can kind of do this in a logical pattern here. What is the idea of the Trivium? We know that it's based on the work of Aristotle and Pythagoras, and we know that it has to do with the Pythagorean triangle, which is we have the 5, 3, and 4 points of the triangle, 5 senses, 3 representing trivium and 4 representing quadrivium. So if you could sum up that idea, and then we'll get into how to practically apply that to our lives.
Yeah, the Pythagorean triangle, there's many different Pythagorean triangles, but the 5, 3, 4 triangle is the simplest one. And that's just a geometric reality. But it just also happens to work in with this whole trivium quadrivium thing. So you have the 5 senses, which you use to, you know, acquire some information. And then you have, it's 5, 3, 4, and particularly because then you start with the trivium. You take all this data you get from your 5 senses and you use the trivium to think about it, to organize it, to make some sense of it. All right. And then you go to the 4, the quadrivium, and that is the study of number, which Jan talked about. So you're studying first mind in the trivium and then matter in the quadrivium. So 5, 3, 4. It makes more sense to do it that way because the 3, the trivium, is your tools of thinking, you know, your tools of learning. And then applying that to the outside world. So 5, 3, 4. That's where that all comes from. I don't actually know who first put that idea together. I haven't actually seen it anywhere else besides from Gino Denning. So it's kind of an interesting little symbol, though, because it is, like I said, a geometric reality in itself. But then it also just happens to work for our purposes. So that's that idea of the 5, 3, 4 triangle and the trivium. The way I'm presenting the trivium is, well, first there are the subjects, okay, the actual subjects of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. But then there's also like a method. It's like a metaphorical use of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which Jan talked about. You're taking in information, you're making sense of it, you're processing it, and then you're feeding that information back out. So there you have your grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So that's the trivium method. And sometimes I think beginning trivium students get confused by this because they're not sure. They're like, well, wait, hold on. They're saying this is the grammar of astrophysics. What do they mean? You know, I'm getting lost here. And that's what people are talking about when they say something like that. Oh, like you're just learning the grammar of astrophysics. You haven't moved to the logic yet. They're talking about the metaphorical model of the trivium. For anybody who might be confused by that, there it is.
Well, in other words, just to clarify, what's happening is we're taking the word grammar literally. And when it's applying to something like astrophysics or whatever it is, we're studying math or we're studying a concept, or a lot of times this is happening online lately where we're kind of dealing with stuff, videos and television shows or whatever it is, and someone will say, well, that's the grammar of it. And a lot of people are thinking, what are you talking about? There is no grammar. I watched a show. So you have to kind of remove yourself from the literal, what we think is the literal meaning of the word, and understand that what we mean when we say we're presented with the grammar of it is we're looking at the basic structure of it now. We haven't really gotten into the logic of what we're dealing with. Is that a safe way to describe it?
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, there's the subject and then the method. Grammar is a subject, and it's also a step in the method. In the trivium method, grammar, logic, and rhetoric just become symbols for steps in the learning process, the three steps of the learning process. Once you realize that there is the difference between the subjects, the literal subjects, and the metaphorical method, then that helps you to understand how somebody is using the terms in that context. So if they're saying, oh yeah, the grammar of that person's speech was off, then you can guess that they're talking about the subject of grammar. Yeah, so as long as you hear that and you know they're talking about the subject, but if they say, oh, you know, you're still trying to comprehend the grammar of astrophysics, you know that they're not really talking about general grammar, you know, nouns and adverbs and stuff. You know that they're talking about the grammar in the metaphorical sense. So I like to make that distinction as clear as possible so that people get less confused by it. And then they see also that there is this method, this way of dealing with information, you know, input processing output, which is like the easiest way to describe it. That pretty much sums it up. You know, you're taking the information in, you're making sense of it, and then you're putting it back out in some way. Okay, so those are the two ways that typically the trivium is discussed. And what I kind of bring to the table, I think it really helps the beginning student more, and that's focusing on what I call trivium skills. Okay, and these are just kinds of skills that you might already have in place in your thinking. It's kind of, you know, like Jan said, it's sort of a natural thing, but we're making it explicit. And I've also just identified certain skills by studying the method and the subjects of the trivium. I think it was, it was Daniel Coffeen's rhetoric lecture, Rhetoric 210, I think it is. UC Berkeley puts out a whole bunch of free courses online, so you can like download the podcasts of them. And so look for Daniel Coffeen's, I believe it's Rhetoric 210. It's the only one that Daniel Coffeen put out, and it's on rhetoric. And in that, he's talking more about the more modern understandings of rhetoric. It's changed a lot since the classical times, which is typically what you study in the trivium in liberal arts. You typically study the classical rhetoric. And so he was talking about it, and I happen to be a fan of classical rhetoric, and he was kind of dismissive of it a bit. He was using some of the moves and teaching some of the things to his students about classical rhetoric, but he was more or less saying something along the lines of they had their own agenda for using rhetoric that he didn't agree with. And I kind of got that. I guess what I learned from that was that, well, yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe there is a certain way that they understood rhetoric to be used back in the day, you know, in the ancient Greeks and Romans. But what's useful for us now is this set of skills, you know, in the subject of rhetoric. And so that got me thinking about this concept of skills and how that applies. And then cut to a few months later, and I got this DVD, Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book. He put out a book in the 20s, How to Read a Book, and then they, I think they republished it or something, or did a new edition in the 70s. So they made a video presentation for it, and that's the DVD that I got. After watching the DVD a couple times, I realized, well, what he's doing basically is going through and describing some of these skills that you're going to need in order to deal with this information. They're skills that you would come across anyway just by studying the trivium subjects, but for me to, you know, tell you or your audience, well, if you want to learn the trivium, just start studying the subjects in order, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. That's a daunting task. I mean, you could spend a long time doing that.
Yeah, well, I think that's the that's where most of us hit the roadblock, is we hear about the trivium and we understand that this is a wonderful concept, and it's something that if we can really wrap our mind around, it will really help us in our lives. And then we kind of hear the preliminary information and we get a little bit overwhelmed, and we're saying, okay, this is, I can't dive into this. This is like somebody telling me, okay, well, why don't you just study astrophysics? And you're thinking, man, I got to make dinner at 4 o'clock. I can't do this. So that's why I want to kind of assure parents, it's not really that daunting of a task. You can apply this to your lives and you can apply this to your reality. And before you continue, Jared, I'll just tell you a story and maybe you can build on this. Like I said, personally, thinking in this way is something that I always felt came natural to me, and actually does come natural to many people, because I think this is the way we're meant to think, and this is the way we're meant to process information. It's just been reversed. It's actually been trained out of us over several decades. So there are just fragments that remain here and there. But I always felt that I had, and my friends would say growing up, that I had an ability to see beneath the surface of a situation. And we weren't sure what I was going to do with that with the rest of my life. But I was always able to really observe something and see it for what it was, instead of what was being presented. So of course the future goes on and I find myself in advertising, which is a very interesting place to use this particular skill, because that's what it's all about in advertising. Only you're on the other side of the table now, and I worked for the creative department, which this is the puppet masters. These are the puppet masters. These are the people that are out there specifically giving you fake information and wanting you to latch on to that fake artificial stimulation. So that was a very interesting experience for me, and I ended up getting out of it. But that's what kind of taught me, or solidified for me, sharpened for me, this ability to be able to see beneath the surface of the situation. So then life goes on, and I start hearing about the whole concept of the trivium when I become a parent, and I'm a home educating parent, and there's all this talk about classical education and Charlotte Mason, and you should teach your kids according to the trivium. And the first thing I do is start to look online and look up on the information. And I'm thinking, well, this seems overcomplicated for a three-year-old. How can I possibly apply this to my life? I can't do this. So they kind of opt for something a little bit more that seems more organized, that's presented in a more organized way, because we're practical people when we're home educating parents. We need everything to be reasonable and to fit into our timetable. So we opt for these things, but we kind of keep, our pendulum keeps swinging back and forth. And we kind of keep saying, no, you know, the whole reason I'm home educating is because I really want to establish critical thinking. I really want to foster critical thinking. And, you know, I don't want my children to be indoctrinated by that system. So how can I do this better? And then we find ourselves, until those of us that are really appreciative of intellectual stimulation and intellectual creativity, kind of find ourselves steering back toward this area of the trivium concept, whether we know it or not. So we go to people like Jan and we hear about it and we take it all in. And I'm sure you've witnessed this, because I've witnessed this just on the forum that we both belong to, is new parents come in and they want to apply it to their lives, but they're intimidated at first, but they're really trying, you know. So just to kind of reiterate the fact and let everybody know, it's already there, it's already in you, and this does not have to be a daunting test. It's just a very simple matter of being able to process information in a different way. Now, the example I'm going to give is one of the first things I did, and I said, okay, here's how I'm going to start to apply it to my family. I went and I was focusing on fallacy, because I think the ability to recognize fallacy in the media really helps train us in that way. So I was watching the pop-up fallacy that Jan Irving, I think it's not only him, but that whole, the video series, the pop-up fallacy. And I got one of those videos, and I got the video for Greenpeace, where they pull apart the commercial for Greenpeace. And this is something that is also easy for me to learn from, because I have that background in advertising and I know that they do these things on purpose. I showed it to my kids, and my kids are young. We're talking about 10, 9, and 7 here. And they watched the raw version first. We talked about it. We talked about what they got from it, how it made them feel angry at adults, and so on and so forth. And then we watched the pop-up fallacy version and we went through it together. And now I feel that I've given my kids now the ability to watch a television program with the Trivium turned on and they were able to see something on TV and say, oh, I see, this is a trick.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, they might not know that they're using something of the Trivium, but essentially that's what's going on. And that's something actually we can get into. There's a specific way of looking at that sort of stance with information that's called the rhetorical triangle. And that's a really useful way of symbolizing and codifying what you're basically teaching your children right there. You know, how to recognize that there is a message here. You know, they're presenting it to you in a certain way, but there's an underlying message here. And, you know, so put yourself apart from that first before you get just sucked in. And yeah, I like to do that with my young son. He's six. Well, my oldest son. He's young. He's six. You know what I mean? I'm not fully awake, folks. And also, I'm a first-year liberal arts student, and I haven't spent too much time on grammar. So you might notice that I speak very well broken English. Okay, that's the one official language that I know I can do well. So, anyway. Yeah, that's huge, though. I think that's great that you do that with your kids. And as long as you're not, like, presenting that idea to them in a way that makes them jaded and, like, just distrustful of the entire world, then it's a great thing because it is giving them that critical ability. You know, I'm very careful with my son not to say that, oh, well, everything you see is a lie. They're just trying to sell to you, you know. You'll get it more when you're older, kid. It's like, well,
yeah. Then you're kind of just doing the same thing then. You're guilty of the same thing if that's what you're doing.
What do you mean? Just like kind of propagandizing?
Yeah.
Them? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're guilty of the same thing. You know, I mean, the whole idea that I'm trying to point out here is that there are ways to practically apply our understanding. But I think you can give us a little bit more detailed information on that. And something that you mentioned to me before about the fact that it's important for us to understand it first and then be able to pass it down to our children.
Yeah, it is. That's I think the most crucial aspect of studying and teaching the Trivium is that you pretty much have to have it under your belt. You don't have to have everything. You don't have to have studied grammar, logic, and rhetoric for a couple of years before you can start teaching it to your children. But you do have to have some knowledge, some understanding, you know, of what's going on here. And so, like you said, you know, there's parents that are coming to this and they're looking at it and they know there's something to it, but they just don't know how to approach it, or it just seems too big and bulky. Like you said, they got to make dinner still. And I recognize that because, like I said, I have very little time to do anything very much. I mean, I spend actually a lot of my free time studying this kind of thing, then only a few other things just to help me relax. You know, I have very little time to actually get into this stuff full on the way a homeschooling parent might. What I'm saying is, I mean, it can be done in small bits. And that's sort of where I come in, because that's what I have to do. Yeah, this is what I've been working on, and focusing first on the skills by giving them the idea that there is the subjects, the literal subjects, then giving them the method, saying, okay, any information that you come across, any subject you want to study, this is the way to do it methodically, okay, systematically, and you'll never get lost. You'll always know what you need to do if you're getting confused or you don't understand something. So by giving them that and then saying, okay, well, here's a set of skills, and by using these set of skills and becoming familiar with them, they will help you approach these Trivium subjects, which seem quite daunting. And during this whole time, I encourage people to read up on the liberal arts as much as they can, you know, from different sources. So they get a pretty universal view of how the liberal arts have been understood throughout time, which also helps them sort of determine what their preferences are, where their emphasis might be, you know, because some people are not going to approach the Trivium in the same way I do, because they might have different interests, different intentions. And so this is something that's been around for a few thousand years. So there's a lot there for you to sort of attach yourself to and make this a really personal endeavor.
Can you elaborate on that just real quick? What, when you say liberal arts, what are you referring to? And why are these liberal arts important?
Yeah, well, the liberal arts, like Jan said, there's the Trivium, the Quadrivium, the Trivium being grammar, logic, rhetoric, the Quadrivium being arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And this is just a well-rounded curriculum that has been developed, that was developed, I mean, thousands of years ago. It goes back to Plato and Aristotle, and there's reason to believe that it's even older than that. But it kind of was codified by Aristotle and Pythagoras. Historically, the liberal arts have been the educational model in the West, at least. You know, I don't know of any specific educational model in the East. I haven't been able to research that far yet, but as far as I know, they don't have something equivalent to this exactly. So, and it's a really powerful curriculum, basically. You had free people and slaves, like in the Roman times, and the free people, who were also citizens, were required to have a liberal education, whereas the slaves were not required, and most often were not allowed to even receive this education. Some of them were, but very few, and essentially they were just the craftsmen, the workers, you know, the grunts. But it was the citizens in the Roman era who received this liberal education specifically. It was meant for them because, you know, they were the free people. And there you have that word, liber, liberty, liberal, you know, that comes from liber. And that means free and it means book. Mm-hmm. So that's just an interesting idea right there. Freedom, books, you know, freedom through books, freedom through book learning, you know, mental liberation. That's what it's all about. So the liberal arts came from the Greeks, then through the Romans, and then, you know, that society collapsed. And pretty much it was the medieval churches that carried it through. There was a guy, Martianus Capella, who wrote The Marriage of Philosophy and Language, I think it was called, something like that. So Capella, C-A-P-E-L-L-A, for anybody who wants to look it up. That was the guy whose work on the liberal arts really was used throughout the Middle Ages. It was like the standard text. And it's very interesting, very fascinating. The language, I would love to get a copy of it in English translation. I haven't been able to find one, but everything I've read of it is great. And it's just this very vivid language. And so that was the liberal arts in the Middle Ages. It was those subjects. And then the church came along and added on theology. And then the liberal arts were just kind of passed along in the West up until the modern times, until about 100 years ago, when it was really sort of, I would say, just walked away from.
Well, the theory is that it was purposely walked away from because, like you were saying, there was the difference between the free men and the slaves. And yeah. Back then, it was pretty clear and it was pretty obvious. The free people were encouraged to have an education and the slaves were discouraged and even not allowed to have an education. I think in our modern day, we're seeing another version of that, really, but it's not so obvious. It's not so blatant. It's more, we're going to have an elite group of citizens that are going to understand how the world works, and the rest of you are going to go to school and have this kind of false understanding of how the world works, because if you're under this false impression, then you'll go around thinking that you're smart, but you're really not. We're just controlling you. And I know that how crazy that sounds to the average person, but here's the thing. The reason it sounds crazy to you, average person, is because you've been trained to believe that something like that is an outrageous idea. And we're back to the importance of having the ability to see beneath the surface of a situation, think critically, and be able to extrapolate real meaning from everything around you in your life. So be that as it may, I'm a parent that's new to this trivium concept, but I get it. I understand how important it is. I myself want to learn how to think more critically. I'd like to be able to foster critical thinking in my children. I'm still kind of confused, though. I'm still kind of daunted. Jared, you're the guy. Help me out here. Give me some advice. How can I begin to learn the concept of trivium and use it in my life in practical ways?
My way of saying get into this right away is by focusing on skills. Now, these skills aren't necessarily going to get you thinking too critically, but they are a part of critical thinking. The one thing that I like about the trivium skills, as I call it the most, is that it just helps you to really beef up your intellectual muscle. You know, for those of us who have gone through the typical public educational curriculum, I would say that most people are just a bit sluggish in the mind. Some people might not agree, but when you start to look at, you know, history and the way people thought, you know, even a couple hundred years ago in America, the quality of understanding and the use of language these people had is just at a young age, it's incredible. It's absolutely remarkable. I remember reading Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. Mm-hmm. And that book really depressed me because I didn't have like this whole trivium thing. I mean, because I was reading that like, holy cow. These people were really, really, really smart, even the poor people. what the hell happened, you know, because I feel dumb. That's, you know, I was always somewhat of an above average student, but I never could really go all the way. I mean, some of these skills I was already trying to use, but I just didn't have enough courage really to fully apply it. And so I sort of got depressed because I saw through school enough. I saw beneath the surface enough, you know, just enough to know that this is not really teaching me how to use my mind. This is teaching me how to become a good worker. And then I got really depressed. I was smoking dope, you know, and then after high school, I just started drinking a lot and, you know, just not doing well for myself. And a few years later, my mind is extremely sluggish. My vocabulary is just horrible. And, you know, my speech patterns are, they sucked, you know, and then I was like, enough is enough. I need to get my mind back. And just as I was making that commitment to myself, the Trivium comes along. So here we are. And I think it's the skills that really will help people get into this because, you know, again, we need a bit more of that intellectual muscle. So let me go through. There's about five general skills that I've identified. There might be more that I might add to this list in time. But for now, I think the five are good enough. And it just gives you some stuff to work with right away before you even touch the Trivium subjects. Okay. And so the first skill would be what Mortimer Adler would call a distinction. It's noticing different types of materials that you're encountering, distinguishing between something that you're going to read for information, something you're going to read for entertainment, or something you're going to read for mental upliftment. And that's a good first step. Just getting people to recognize that if they're not already able to distinguish between something that's just entertainment and something that's for mental upliftment. And then there's also the problem that a lot of people don't understand exactly how to read. And by that, I don't mean actually, you know, reading the words on the page and understanding. They don't understand how to read specifically for mental upliftment because we're not taught this in school. And usually when you go on to college and higher level education, you sort of have to learn this method of reading. You know, you sort of just have to figure it out on your own because that's the only way you can get through the courses. And that's actually, I don't even think the first 4 years of college. I think it's like postgraduate studies where you really get into learning how to read. Making that distinction of reading something specifically for mental upliftment, okay, and then all these skills that follow sort of build on that. So my presentation, which is out now, and you can find it on the Trivium Binder website, it's using clips from Adler's How to Read a Book DVD. But I also make the point very often in that presentation that these skills don't just apply to reading. They don't just apply to reading for upliftment. It also applies for, you know, your everyday life when you're talking to people. Okay, so right there you have a distinction between the types of books you're reading and for what purpose you're reading them. Think of that in the terms of conversation as well. You know, what kind of conversations are you having? Are you having only conversations that are informational or entertaining throughout your day? Are you having any conversations that seem to uplift you mentally, that really go deep and engage you, you know, that challenge you? And that's a distinction I think is very important for people to make because the culture in America is such that it's not comfortable to have really deep, you know, intellectually stimulating conversations often, and especially not so much in public because people realize they might not know what they're talking about or they think they know what they're talking about and they're not willing to find somebody else's point of view. You know, we don't have very many cultural mores and just habits that allow us to get really deep. So yeah, and I've heard that a lot about Europe nowadays, that you can still go to places and people are, you know, discussing philosophy on the streets. It's like another world. So that's one skill. And the next skill would be taking notes, okay, which everybody's familiar in some point of their life. They've had to take notes for whatever it is, a class or something. Adler presents this in a bit of a different way. As far as books go, he's talking about actually writing in your books, which to me was like, yes, that's awesome. Thank you for giving me that permission. Because, and I say that because when I was a kid in high school, I remember reading Brave New World Revisited. I stole it from the school library. I'm sorry. I'm just being honest here. But I was like, I got to read this. There's something in here for me to learn. And there's all these big words I didn't understand. And so I started underlining some of these words. And then immediately I felt bad about doing that. Like there was this little like mother culture voice in my ear saying, you can't do that because there's like this aesthetic quality to books. You know, they're supposed to be nice on the shelves, and then you can give them to your friends. You don't want to give them something that's all marked up. You know, what's the point of that? That's horrible. You're damaging this property. You know, so for whatever reason, I just didn't have the courage to mark my books up. But Adler says, no. Make that book your own. Mark them up. Take notes in the book. And if you can't, take notes on paper. But essentially, he's saying underline words you don't understand, you know, circle, highlight, whatever, you know, passages that interest you or that puzzle you. And so he's talking about a sort of extra dimension to taking notes here. He's saying these notes that you're taking are going to help you to really get into the work that you're reading. And this goes back to the trivium method a bit, where you have the grammar stage where you're just getting familiar with something. You're just trying to see like sort of the general view, the big picture. And then you go to the understanding stage where you really dig in and you get in up close with the information and you start to make sense of it. So with the method of reading here presented, you're reading it the first time and you're taking your notes because you don't want to stop for too long. If you don't understand something, just keep going, keep reading. If you don't know this word, don't necessarily grab your dictionary, just underline it. Because this first reading, you just want to get the big picture view of what the author is presenting to you. Okay, you don't want to get stuck on, you know, Marx's definition of capitalism, you know, because you'll spend all of your time just trying to understand that, you know, when you just want to get the whole big picture. All right, so taking notes is a huge skill. And when you're listening to somebody talk, you can't really do this in conversation, obviously, except maybe mentally, but when you're listening to somebody speak, it's also a good idea to be an active listener, as he would say. Taking notes, he considers active reading, or how to stay awake while reading. But active listening is, you know, somebody's in front of you, well, get a piece of paper and a pen and start taking notes, ideas that come up, because you want to still stay engaged and follow their argument, but you might kind of forget some ideas that had come up at the beginning of the argument or presentation. An argument here should be understood in the liberal sense. Argument is not people yelling at each other and fighting. It's not about contention. That's like the least form of argument. Argument really is presenting ideas, hopefully in a logical manner, trying to either persuade or inform people, or just for saying, okay, here's what I think based on this. What do you think? Let's try and come to some truth together using our powers of reasoning. So that's really what an argument is in this sense, okay? So you're listening to somebody's argument, you want to take some notes. You want to be an active listener, okay? So that's another important skill that I've identified. And again, Adler lays this all out in How to Read a Book, the DVD. And I was just amazed because some of these skills I had identified myself, and then there he is talking about it for 10 minutes, okay? So these are the clips that I use in my presentation. The third skill is, oh yes, coming to terms, which is something that you learn about in the subject of logic. Coming to terms is very important. Let's say in a conversation, we're talking about love, okay? You and I are talking about love, but your definition of love personally is different than my definition of love. We're not really going to get to any understanding in our conversation. We're not really going to get anywhere if we have two different definitions for the same word, you see? So when you're coming to terms, when you're defining your terms, in conversation, you're saying, well, what do you mean by love? Because I think you have a different sense of that, and we have to have that understanding first, so we are both talking about the same thing. Now, in a book, you can't talk to the author. I mean, it's a one-sided conversation somewhat. He's not going to respond. So you're defining the terms in your own way by taking your notes and saying, okay, he's using this term love over and over, but I noticed he means it in a certain sense here, and he means it in a different sense here. So this author is using the same term in different ways. So I have to define for myself the meaning of this term in this sense and the meaning of this term in that other sense. Sometimes an author uses one term and has one definition only for that term. Okay, so when Marx talks about capitalism, he has a very specific definition that he never wavers from. So defining terms is very crucial. And again, in conversations, I've just seen it happen so many times where people think they're talking about the same thing, but if you just probe a little bit, they really don't know what they're talking about because they have two different definitions going on for the same term. You know, and then sometimes also somebody's saying something and you say, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean when you say love? And they look at you like, well, now that I think about it, I don't really know.
Right.
That happens to me quite a bit, personally, where I'll be talking and then I just realize, oh, shit, I don't know what I'm saying. You know, like, okay, I need to actually put some thought into this before I just start blabbing my mouth. So,
well, the difference is that you're able to recognize when you find yourself in that situation where, whereas I think most of the people in today's society, most of us aren't able to recognize that and stop ourselves.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, self-consciousness, self-awareness is not promoted in many corners of this society right now. And that's a horrible, horrible thing. And then also we have these sort of infantile egos going on here that are promoted. And so when somebody does kind of become self-aware and they realize something like, oh, I don't know what I'm talking about, they get pissed off, they get angry, mm-hmm. you know? And if you point that out to them, that anger gets directed at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ego is definitely a problem that we have in our culture. And this is really quite a conundrum, because I don't think any of us really deserve the ego that we're walking around with.
Yeah,
because we're really not thinking critically. We've forgotten as a society how to engage in an intelligent debate and dissent. We have lost the ability to really engage in active listening and participate in a conversation in that way. And yet we have these giant egos that constantly need to be stroked. Now, I know that's something that I've dealt with, that I deal with on a constant basis, is I seem to have an issue with my own ego, but I feel that I've come a long way in at least being able to recognize, okay, I have ego issues and I need to put that aside if I'm going to engage in an intelligent debate with someone.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that too, because and from my own experience, you know, I have quite an ego on me and it gets in my way. And so I have to be on guard and recognize that, because sometimes if I get carried away, I can be a dick. It's very important, though, that we check our egos at the door, I like to say.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, that to me, that is actually taking a step in the right direction, is to be able to recognize and say, okay, I have this issue and I could recognize when it's happening. And that's the first step in being able to deal with it a little bit more effectively and get through that boundary, because it does really put up a blockade to our ability to think critically. Mm-hmm. Is we get ourselves wrapped up in ourselves, so to speak. Now, let's just kind of round back and review a little bit before we move forward, so we understand the direction that we're going in. We have parents listening, myself included, that understand the trivium, understand the concept, but we're a little overwhelmed. We're looking for kind of just practical advice on how to move through this process. And some of the advice that you're given, you're kind of breaking it down into steps. And we talked about the ability to take notes, but we talked about also taking in the whole before we try to go back and concentrate on the details. So we're going to take in the whole, we're going to take notes, and then we're going to go back and we're going to concentrate on the details after. We talked about also the power of argument and coming out of the power of argument. We talked about coming to terms, and coming to terms is something that you're describing right now, and realizing that people are defining things in different ways, and that's what finds us often at an impasse. So if we're able to, it's simply a matter of paying attention to these things in our everyday lives, is what you're saying. So we're looking for practical ways to learn the trivium. And I think the point that we're trying to make here with you, Jared, is in the method, when you're trying to apply this to your life, is simply to be aware and to start applying it to your everyday life. When you're in a conversation with someone, or when you're reading a book, or when you're watching a show, just kind of be more aware and start thinking in these ways. So can you just double back and reiterate on the three steps that you went over, even if you just mentioned them quickly, as far as taking notes, taking in the whole, and then coming to terms?
And then distinguishing between the types of material that you're encountering. You know, that's kind of like the first thing. Like, what am I doing here when I'm reading or having a conversation? Is it entertainment, information, or is it mental upliftment? And then, you know, yeah, taking notes, defining terms. And this all goes along with the trivia method as well. The trivia method is always present in anything you do, pretty much. And that's sort of the goal that you're going for, is to take these skills and the method and to learn it well enough that it's sort of just a part of your normal thinking process. That it's like going in the background. You don't have to spend too much conscious energy pulling this stuff up. It's just already there. It's going. You know, you want it to be habitual in your life of thought. Yeah, these skills don't seem like much, but when you put them together, when you start applying them, and then you have the trivia method, I mean, that alone right there is a lot of critical thinking going on. And then when you actually get to the subjects of the trivium, you know, especially when you're talking about logic and rhetoric, now you're really in the critical thinking field. So again, what we're doing here is, before we're approaching the subjects, we're giving them the broad view of the method, but then we're also kind of pulling back a little bit and saying, okay, well, let's start really simply and let's work with these skills first. Okay. So that's my way of presenting the trivium pretty much. And it's I haven't seen anybody else present it in this way. And I think this is the most helpful way for beginners, for people who are not trying to take in too much at once because they don't have the time or whatever, you know, and they need to start in small bits. And that's where the skills come in. So we've talked about distinguishing what you're reading. We've talked about defining terms and taking notes. Another skill, something that you more or less just used, the paraphrase. And this is a huge one. The paraphrase is, I mean, to sum it up, is to take a passage, a piece of information, and then to rephrase it in your own terms. While the logical consistency, the ideas remain, you know, the essential core ideas that are being transmitted remain, but the words that it's clothed in are changed. So the paraphrase is very huge. It to me, it's the one that really helps you build some intellectual muscle, okay? Because it gets you in touch with the processes of thought, with the structures of thinking. All right, so you can take the paraphrase right away and you want to apply it in your life, you want to apply it in your everyday. Do this. Take a conversation you had today and paraphrase it in one sentence. Say basically what that conversation was about, okay? Do it in one sentence. It might be easy, it might be hard, but no matter what, just try paraphrasing a conversation you had today or yesterday into one sentence. And now, after doing that, paraphrase it in three sentences. So now you have to say basically the same thing, but now instead of one sentence, you're saying it in three sentences, a whole lot more words. And that right there is a very challenging thing to do. But again, we're building intellectual muscle because that's just going to help us all the more with our studies of the trivium subjects. And the more that we have all of these things, these skills, the method and the subjects in place and going on in our minds, the easier it is going to be to translate to our children who need an individual touch, who are all different, you know, and there's no one size fits all method here. There's no one right way to do it. But when you have the skills and the method in place, then you can figure out how to use these subjects and how to present them to your children. So that's what we're going through right now. The paraphrase, okay? So that's a huge one. That's something that, like, Benjamin Franklin, he credits the paraphrase as one of the essential things that helped him educate himself. All right? He had very little schooling. He also credits a book on grammar that also contained sections on logic and rhetoric, by the way, as part of his education. But the paraphrase was a huge one. He took this newspaper called The Spectator that he said had some great writing in it. He would take a story from The Spectator and jot down some really quick notes. A couple days later, he would not look at the story. A couple days later, then he would just briefly look at his notes and try and rewrite that story as well as he could, not using the exact language, but using his own terminology, his own words. You know, but still saying the same thing. And then a few days later, he would check his work and see how close his paraphrase of the original was, okay? And then he would be able to determine then, oh, well, I was way off here. Or actually, I was pretty good. And here was a few good lines that I actually wrote too that were somewhat better than the original. You know, so this was just a method that Benjamin Franklin used. Abraham Lincoln as well, he said something to the effect that, well, you know, I used to listen to high-level conversations as a child and read a lot of books, and I just did a lot of work trying to make sense of them and by, you know, stating things in my own terms, my own way. So the paraphrase is another skill, and again, you can start applying it right now if you want. You can stop listening to this episode and just paraphrase what you've heard up to this point. Just paraphrase it in one sentence and then in three sentences. You know, that's just what I like to tell people as an exercise to get started. Okay, and then there's the paraphrase, and then another skill is, it's somewhat similar to the paraphrase, but essentially it's finding the argument. And in books, you're going to look for key sentences. So this is a bit more of a broader skill that you might not apply so much in everyday life, but let's say in conversation, somebody is talking to you, and they're using words, and you understand what those words mean, but you also sense a hidden meaning or a deeper meaning in their words. They're implying something, or they're not saying something, okay? So they're presenting an argument, quote unquote, to you, and they're using these words that, if taken literally, would mean one thing, but you know they're kind of saying something else. So you have to figure out what that is. You have to find what their argument really is. And then, so then you ask them questions, or you just listen intently and try and logically figure it out. That's in conversation. So sometimes it can be kind of hard to actually find that person's argument if they're trying to hide it from you, okay, like a politician. All right, but in a book, it's a bit easier because you can look for key sentences. And these key sentences are basically just sentences that more or less summarize a major point in that book's argument. Now, a story isn't necessarily going to be an argument, although they do have morals and ideas embedded in them, but we're thinking more of like works of philosophy, the classic literature. So in Aristotle's Politics, there's going to be certain key sentences that he then goes to describe at length. Okay, so you'll become more familiar with this stuff that I'm talking about as well when you listen to my presentation. The presentation, which will be available at the Trivium Binder, is available right now. So we can move on from the skills now and start getting into some more actual practical applications of things that I've found from the actual Trivium subjects. And you're talking about critical thinking. And I think if we're going to talk about critical thinking, it's important. Yes, the logical fallacies are important because you want to identify when somebody's thinking is unsound. So that's important to have. But the rhetorical triangle, this is something that comes out of the subject of rhetoric. The rhetorical triangle is absolutely crucial for parents to understand for teaching critical thinking. The rhetorical triangle, you can just picture in your mind a triangle. On the top point of the triangle is the audience, okay? Bottom left point is the message. The bottom right point would be the speaker. Imagine a circle around the triangle, or some people actually put the circle inside of the triangle. The circle would be the context. So let's talk about a commercial for chewing gum, okay? And we used to have those. What was it? The twins, that chewing gum commercial. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Doublemint, double your pleasure.
Doublemint twins. Yeah, double your pleasure. Oh God. Okay, this is a perfect example. So here you have your rhetorical triangle. You have your audience, which is, you know, the consumer. Okay, now let's imagine we're the ad agency. You used to work in advertising. And advertising really is just, it's a lower form of rhetoric. You know, it's a very advanced use of it. I mean, the advertising these days, I mean, they're so manipulative. It's just disgusting to me.
They are the puppet masters.
It's gross, but it's a great example. So here, Doublemint twins. They're your audience, that's your consumers you're going for, your message, and then you, the speaker. Now, you have a product that you're trying to sell to the audience, the consumers. So you craft a message, and you have this whole context thing to deal with. You want to have, you know, you don't really care if they're male or female consumers, customers, whatever. And you know that sex sells. So instead of just saying, try our gum, it's really good, you're going to say, look at these hot blondes, and there's two of them, guys. You know what that means. You know, there's that hidden message. There's lovely music. Maybe they're riding horseback or something. You see these images that make you feel good. All of this stuff is just designed to bypass your critical thinking and get you at the level of your subconscious emotions and desires. Okay? So without the rhetorical triangle, you might not really realize that. Okay? But when you have the rhetorical triangle, you're watching television, Doublemint commercial comes on, immediately you go into this rhetorical triangle mode, let's say, and you say, oh, okay, I'm the audience, there's the product, there's the message coming from this company. Let me analyze that message, you know, before I let it get through me, get through my skin, you know, and get into my my wallet. Let me see what this message is telling me first and compare it to the product they're selling and what I know about this company and this kind of product. Let me think about all these things first, and then I'll determine if I want to spend some money and buy this gum. So then you're looking and you're seeing, oh, well, two hot blondes. Hey, that's a great thing. Oh, wait, they're using sex to sell this. Well, that's a bit insulting, if you ask me. You know, that's cutting below my intelligence level. You know, and they're just showing me a nice, pretty scene and beautiful women, and then saying, oh, well, somehow this all has to do with, you know, Doublemint gum.
You know, Jared, I see this kind of method, and I think I'm able to recognize it more because of the brief experience that I had in this industry. And like I said, I worked in the creative department. So I was part of the team that purposely went out of our way to sit down at a round table and say, okay, how are we going to convince these fools that they need this product? And those words would sometimes literally come out of their mouths. It's very scary. Once you really get in there, you realize what's going on there. And just on a side note, they never do drug testing in advertising, because if they did, the industry wouldn't exist. So that just tells you something about that. But I see this present a lot in pharmaceutical ads, not necessarily blatant sexual overtones. They're kind of very, very undertones, unless we're talking about Viagra. But it's more or less that they're showing you pictures of very happy, healthy people. Here's, you know, a woman in her 60s, and she looks great, and she's walking her dog on the beach, and she doesn't have any pain in her legs, and if you take this pill, then your arthritis will go away. And that's kind of, we're very swayed by the images. And I also see sex selling a lot in these cologne commercials and Axe commercials and razor commercials. The money they're spending to sell a razor is phenomenal. And what I'm noticing, Jared, is most of these products are geared towards men. So what we're first seeing is that they're approaching the sexual primal sexual feeling in men, trying to make them think, okay, you're going to wear this cologne or you're going to use this razor and you're going to get this beautiful hot woman, because there's always got to be a beautiful woman involved in the commercial. But what's going on there is they're also selling us, because they know that we're the ones that are at the supermarket buying these products for our boyfriends and for our husbands, and they're getting into our psyche and they're getting into our sexual prowess by making us feel that we will be that beautiful woman.
Yeah.
If we buy our husband this product. So, I mean, there's layers going on there, and when you're able to see it, then you're not as vulnerable to it. I guess that's the point, is that by using the Trivium and by using this critical thinking process, you are no longer the slave. You are no longer just the idiot consumer that's going to buy anything that's sold to you.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say that is the sole purpose of studying the Trivium, but that's what happens when you start to work with the Trivium, is this critical thinking just becomes a habitual part of your life of thought. You know, essentially you're here to learn how to learn. You learn how to uplift your mind, right? To enrich your life, to become a better person. You want to be more interesting. Liberal arts studies should not make you more boring. And if it is, you're doing something wrong. Okay. It should make you more interesting. It should make you somebody that, you know, can take this information and repackage it and tell a wonderful story or a moral or, you know, just transmit information very efficiently and things like that. And then also you're able to read anything. Like I say in my presentation, any subject is available to you now. It doesn't matter if it's astrophysics or if it's Japanese cuisine. Both of those subjects are now equally accessible to you. Even if you think you can't handle astrophysics, you can. You just have to apply the Trivium method. It's going to take a lot longer. You're going to spend a lot more time in the grammar and the logic stage of astrophysics than you will in the grammar and logic stage of Japanese cuisine, okay? But
we're supposed to. We're supposed to spend time learning. We're supposed to spend more time thinking and learning and philosophizing on the world around us, and less time goofing off and engaging in superficial conversation, you know, because that makes us more vulnerable to all the artificial stimulation going on. And like you said, it's not all about just protecting yourself from spending your money in unwise ways, but it's also about, you know, you take this to the voting booth. Now you're able to listen to the politicians and really understand the world around you and understand the political environment and social environment around you, and take real knowledge into the voting booth with you, because you're able to make decisions based on information and not based on just what you've been given. You're also able to just enjoy your life more when you pick up a book that's just for enjoyment and you're reading just for pleasure and it's just fiction. You're going to get so much more out of that when you're able to really get more meaning out of it. So it really does give you a better life in general.
Yeah, and one of the arguments against liberal arts education is that, well, it's not really preparing kids for college and for, you know, the work environment. And it's like, well, actually it is, because these kids can handle anything. If you're liberally educated, you can handle anything. You can pick things up real quick. You might not have the same set of facts, you know, that has been pumped into your head for 12 years or for whatever, but you can catch up pretty damn quickly. And once you do, you're going to keep going. You're not going to just catch up with the other students. You're going to pass them. And they're going to be like, what the hell happened to that guy?
Well, that goes back to the argument about home education, where they'll say, well, it doesn't really prepare kids for students and work. And the old adage with home education is, well, no, home education, a public school environment will prepare students to work and to be workers and to engage in the workforce. But home education and independent learning and learning with critical thinking and liberal arts will prepare their bosses. and the people that are going to run the companies and be the heads of industries.
Hell yeah. Amen to that.
So that's what we're coming back to here is, okay, no, I'm not, probably my kids are not going to be prepared to work in an environment where they're going to be inside of a cubicle and, you know, working for somebody else, but they will be prepared to run that company.
Well, and let's say that your child was liberally educated and they don't end up as that. They work in a warehouse. You know, that's the situation I'm in. I wasn't liberally educated, but let's just say, you know, either way, they end up working in a warehouse. They might not be happy, but let's say it's the only gig in town, right? Let's just say that, for example, like in my situation, I'll just use myself, I guess. I work at a job. It's the best job in town. I can't find another one that even comes close to the pay that I need. You know, I got to have a place to live, somewhere for my kids and all this stuff. And so I'm stuck in a warehouse because, yeah, I made a lot of mistakes, but that's besides the point. So working in a warehouse with the Trivium, at least doing something that is like really like soul killing in a lot of ways, at least I have the Trivium so that I have the ability to really enrich myself and to make some use of my free time instead of just going to work and then coming home and watching television, drinking beer, whatever, you know, spending time with the family. And this is something Adler talks about, is the way we use our time. He differentiates between work, and then he has the concepts of rest and play. And then he says there's also something called leisure. And I always thought leisure to be a combination of rest and play. But he says, no, this is the time we should be setting apart to do the important things like learning, you know, and voting, the duties of friendship, art. You know, this is a specific distinction he makes in our free time. The free people of the past received this kind of education just so that they could have leisure, to spend their leisure wisely. That's why they were all citizens and took part in voting and took part of the politics of the day. The slaves were not allowed to do that stuff because they didn't have the education required for leisure time. Now in this modern era, we have the combination of what the slaves had and what the free people had. We have the work. We have to go and do labor. But we also have a lot of free time that we can do whatever we want with. And here you have a culture that has no concept of leisure. And in fact, all we're doing is spending all of our time in entertainment and distractions and selfish pursuits and in just sitting around being lazy. And obviously this doesn't go for everybody, but I'm just generalizing. And that's what we're talking about here with the liberal arts. You're learning how to spend some leisure time, some true leisure time. And it's really uncomfortable and awkward still saying that term leisure, because again, I've always understood leisure to mean just kind of laid back, you know, rest, play. But Adler says, no, this is an actual historical distinction that has been made since at least the Roman times. And, you know, there's an etymology to it. And this is the distinction in our free time that we must make in order to really be proper citizens.
Well, I think the difference is, Jarrett, there is a difference, and we're learning this now, between quality leisure and waste of time leisure.
Well, see, he wouldn't distinguish that, Adler, and I'm just repeating his information. He wouldn't distinguish that. There's only leisure. There's no ill way to spend leisure. If you're not engaged in leisurely pursuits, then you're just doing some type of recreation. If you're just watching television, that's not leisure at all.
That's the distinction that I'm trying to make, is that when you're doing these things, you're not really engaging in leisure, or engaging is a weird word for leisure, but you're not, this isn't really a quality leisure experience.
Yeah.
This is something else.
Yeah, that might be actually a better way to use the term than the way Adler uses it, because there's this connotation we have of leisure. You know, that's something Jan talks about, how words, important words, the meaning changes. It mm-hmm. seems to change. And so, yeah, this concept of leisure, it might be better to talk about it, that there's two different qualities. There's a higher and a lower quality of leisure. I kind of like that because, I mean, really, we got to have some way of talking about a better way to spend our damn time, because mm-hmm. there's just too much shit going on. So anyway, we're getting distracted. Let's get back into this practical stuff. With the rhetorical triangle, it's just, again, that's a huge one. That gets you in touch with the subject of rhetoric. That's where this comes from. And then actually there's a book called Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student by Corbett and Connors. Awesome book. Totally worth the price of admission. I mean, brand new, I think the book's like $70. It's like a college level course book. Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student. If you can get your hands on it, it's huge, huge resource. And it'll get you involved directly with the world of rhetoric, the art of rhetoric, the actual subject of rhetoric. Okay. And from there, then that begins your lifelong study of rhetoric. Okay. So, and that's where I first encountered this rhetorical triangle, which is just, again, it's a way to just systematically apply critical thinking in the moment, not after the fact, but while something is happening. You can automatically say, there's the message being given to me. There's the sender of the message. Here's the context that we're involved in. where do I fit here? You know, what part of this message do I want to let penetrate my wallet or my desires or whatever it may be? You know, and you can use the rhetorical triangle in any situation in which you're encountering information. So you're reading a book. There you go again. Put that author in the message sender corner, the book, the actual words in the message corner, and you, the audience, in the other corner. You know, and then there too, you don't have to be taken in by whatever the author says, because a lot of people are that way. They're an open book, so to speak. They're easily impressed upon. You know, they're totally suggestible. And when you stop doing that, when you can detach yourself from the situation without completely leaving the situation, then that's the beginning of critical thinking. So we're talking about practical applications. There you go. Rhetorical triangle. You can get on that one right away. Should I mention a couple things about teaching children?
If you have some examples of practical ways to share this with children, let's hear some of those examples.
Yeah, because I imagine a lot of your audience has young children as well.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's worth repeating that parents got to learn this stuff first, you know, because it really, we're talking about liberal arts, and I want to stress the art part, okay? We got to be artistic. We have to be creative, put our own individuality, our own soul into this. Like, there's no one right way to do it, you know? And again, like, if the liberal arts is making you dry and boring, you're doing something wrong. So, all right, I took some notes here. There's two resources that I think are helpful for parents with children. And one is the essay by Dorothy Sayers called The Lost Tools of Learning. And the other is a book, Teaching the Trivium, and it's about Christian homeschooling in the classical style. And I'm sure some of your audience is even familiar with it. Now, if Christian homeschooling is not your thing, this book is still highly useful, because I'm personally not involved in the idea of Christian homeschooling. I'm not much interested in it, but I find so much value in this book. They also use that trivium method format of grammar, logic, and rhetoric in the metaphorical sense. So let's talk about that. With young children, up to about the age of 10 to 12, they're in the grammar stage. Or as Dorothy Sayers, the Lost Tool of Learning author, would say, the poll parrot stage, where it's easy for them to kind of just memorize facts and figures and just repeat things back. Kids repeat, repeat, repeat all day long. Everything I say, I end up hearing from my children again later in the day. Which is very tough when you got a mouth like a trucker. What did he just say? Oh my God, that was my fault. It's like, nope, that's a daddy word, okay? You can't say daddy words. So in the Teaching the Trivium book, they talk about the grammar stage of your child's development. And that's when their brain is still not fully formed. You know, they don't really have like the logic centers that can handle like the higher level stuff that comes later. They're asking questions, but it's mostly just, they just don't know what the hell's going on around them. They're not trying to like put pieces together. They're just asking, what is that? What is that? That they're acquiring pieces of grammar. Okay. The metaphorical grammar. They're acquiring just the basic building blocks of information about the world around them. And then later on, as they grow older, they start to move these pieces around. And that's when they start asking the real questions, you know, what is life all about? That kind of thing. That's in the logical stage of their development. So when they're still in the grammar stage, there's two things to focus on, as they say in Teaching the Trivium, the ability of observation and then memory. And for an example, oral narration is something that really helps them build their memory and also facility with language. So oral narration, I think it's Charlotte Mason. I think that's one of her things. And so all you're doing is taking like a parable or a passage from a book or a short story or something. You're reading that to your child. And then after you're done reading it, you ask them to repeat that story back to you like in their own way and see what they remember and what ideas they're able to comprehend. And then you just sort of work with them a little bit and say, okay, well, what about this part? Do you remember when this part happened? Oh, yeah. And then this happened and this happened, you know. So when they're young, you got to work with them. They're not going to get it all right away. But the more you work with oral narration, the quicker they become, the more they remember from the stories you read, and the better they are at repeating the ideas back to you in their own words. So there you go. There's that skill of paraphrase. So oral narration is a huge one with kids. And that's a great thing, too, because, you know, I like to read like Aesop's fables and stuff like that to my boy. And I don't get too much time to work with a lot of this stuff with them, unfortunately. We do some of this work and it shows. It shows. Observation and memory are the two things we're really focusing on in the grammar stage. And that one deals a lot with memory and then self-expression.
Jared, you're speaking my language right now, and I am very excited, actually, and anxious to have you on for another show, maybe even two shows to go into these, because I'd like to go into the Trivian concept a little bit further on a philosophical level. If you've listened to my show for any length of time, you know that you are actually speaking my language to the T, and I'd love to talk about this with you again sometime. For now, we're going to have to round it off, though, and you know, kind of smooth out the edges a little bit and remind our audience how we can find more about practical application. You had some book recommendations. Can you just reiterate those?
Yes. There is The Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student. And that puts you in touch also with a little bit of grammar and some logic as well. So you kind of get the whole Trivium thing going on right there. And now you're not going to find the actual Trivium method explained in too many books, but you do find it in that Teaching the Trivium book, the Christian homeschooling one I mentioned, by the Bluedorns, Harvey and Laurie Bluedorn. And I highly recommend it. There's the Trivium book by Sister Miriam Joseph, which is not beginner's material. It is very academic. But I think if you're going to study the Trivium, just go ahead and buy it anyway. And keep maybe you read the first few chapters, and then it starts to get a little hard for you, and you put it back on the shelf, and it collects dust for a few months. You'll end up coming back to it. Because as you learn the subjects of the Trivium, and they're a little bit more comprehensible to you, the Trivium book by Sister Miriam Joseph will make a lot more sense, and you'll be able to start working with it pretty well. But I think for beginners, it's a bit tough. But again, it's worth having on the shelf.
What about the Well-Trained Mind?
The Well-Trained Mind, I don't know that one. I know the Well-Educated Mind. Those are the two from Susan Weisbauer.
Mm-hmm.
So the Well-Trained Mind, I've heard good and bad things about, but I just haven't gotten a copy of it myself. And that's like their whole like course for doing homeschooling using the classical methods and this, that, and the other thing. I just don't know it. But the Well-Educated Mind, I have it sitting right here in front of me, and it's a great one. And then that also discusses the Trivium method, looking at things in the grammar, logic, and rhetoric metaphorically. And it applies to reading the classical works. Because that's a big part of liberal education, is taking these skills and developing yourself through the study of books. You're not reading Aristotle so that you can just know what Aristotle said or to agree with them. You're reading it to get in touch with some of the greatest thinking that has ever been put down on paper. That's a big part of what's going on here. It's mental development. It's intellectual upliftment. You know, so it's not just trying to know what all the great philosophers of the past have had to say and being able to repeat that, because you know a lot of things they say don't mix well. A lot of them contradict each other, and you're going to disagree with some of the things they say, but you're also going to agree. So you discover these things as you go, and the Well-Educated Mind is a really great way to get into reading the classical books using the Trivium method. And then another one for reading books, Mortimer Adler, How to Read a Book. You know, I can't say enough good about Mortimer Adler. Some people find him really dry and boring and a bit too smart for normal people, but I think he's a great teacher. I'm a big fan of Mortimer Adler, as much as I don't like a lot of things about him. He's too damn logical.
Well, you know, it's funny when you say some people consider him a bit too smart for normal people. That to me is really a kind of a sad reflection on our society as a whole. We should all be at that level, really.
Yeah. Absolutely. And he was a big fan of the idea that everybody is a philosopher. You know, to be a philosopher is just a function of the human condition, the human intellect that we all have to some degree.
Well, John Talagato said that children are born geniuses and then it's schooled out of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I agree with that. You know, one kid might not be as great of a genius as the other. We're not all going to be Shakespeare's and Einstein's. You know,
but
that's
we're
just
not all going to have our genius funneled into the same direction or, you know, going into the same direction. But we are all individually capable of reaching greatness in our own areas. We just don't know that we are, and we need to be reminded as a society. And, you know, man, I would love to go on for another hour about just that.
I know, right?
I see a lot of shows in the future coming up with you, and I see a lot of discussion and conversation coming up with you. And I'm thankful that I've been able to connect with you. And I'm thankful that you came on the show and gave us all this awesome information that we're able to really dig into now and really move forward in, because I think that it's really going to help us all in the home education community and the community at large. Now, if there is someone out there that is listening that would like to get in touch with you personally, that has any questions for you, is there a way that someone can reach you and ask more questions?
Yeah, I would love for that. I was actually going to mention just now that if anybody has any more questions about this or just any comments or disagreements or they just want to say hi or whatever, just send an email to thenextsteppodcast@gmail.com.
Okay, and all of that information will accompany this recording, so you can just go ahead and look at the website and you can figure out how to reach either myself, of course, or Jared and talk more about this. We welcome your comments and questions and ideas and anything that you have to say. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jared, and thank you, listeners, as always, for listening. This was Jared Sanchez on The Trivium, and I am Laurette Lynn, your host, the Unplugged Mom, here to always and forever talk you right out of your comfort zone and get you thinking and rethinking about how we live, learn, and operate in this society. Thank you so much and have a great day, everyone.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider going to unpluggedmom.com and making a donation. It is your donations that make Unplugged Mom Podcast possible. Visit unpluggedmom.com today.